Good afternoon, everyone. And on behalf of the Campus Community Committee, I'm very pleased to welcome everyone here to today's presentation. This is the time of the year when I think our anxiety levels are a bit up. After all, many of us come to work when it's still dark, and we go home when it's already dark. And it doesn't mean we come in too early or we go home too late, but this is one of the times of the year with the academic season in session, particularly exam times and so forth. There's a lot further activity. And then when you get a day like today with rain, sort of our levels go up as well. So I think the talk is an appropriate talk at this time of the year. We're very pleased to have Dr. Ian Bradley is our presenter. Ian is a psychologist trained at the University of Waterloo. They don't have a bad program over there.
Hey, thank you.
It was actually, at that time, it was the only Canadian school that was accredited by the American Psychological Association. He started off primarily doing his work with children, with stuff done in Los Angeles and autistic children with whom he worked with in Vancouver. Ian is an assistant professor in both departments of psychiatry and psychology, and he also teaches an undergraduate course in cognitive behavior therapy. He was a psychologist in chief of the Royal Victoria Hospital and led a team of over 30 different psychologists. Interesting enough that he changed the orientation of that particular group, moving from, shall we say, assessment testing to one really where they were doing active treatment in areas particularly stress management, depression, sexual dysfunction, and gambling itself. He's also served as the EAP psychologist for the National Hockey League Players Association, and probably many of them could use their services right now as they sit and twiddle their thumbs. And for the last 2 years of the Expos, while they were in town, he was also the mental health consultant. He specializes in the area of workplace psychology, now doing work for small and medium types of enterprises, as well as the fact that he's a practicing executive coach. So it's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Ian Bradley, who's going to talk to us about Know Your Enemy Stressors at Work. Ian.
Great. Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for the introduction. I just realized in the introduction that I'm going to be completely useless because I'm equally impaired by the lack of light and the rain. So environmental stressors are not my thing. I want to talk about, as I was coming down today, I was saying I'm feeling better in my life than I ever did before, and it's because I'm not like you, I hate to say this, in the sense that I'm not working with a lot of people, I'm not working for an organization, and I'm doing just what I love to do, which is psychology. And so I'm going to try to talk about that today, and the idea that sometimes it's that we love something, and that's why we go into it, but we end up hating it or being stressed because of the organizational context that that job is embedded in, or the people that you have to deal with. So I'm going to talk about those things as we go along. Let me just get over here. More formally, in terms of themes, I'm going to begin talking about four themes. The first one is a micro view of work. So I'm going to talk about the psychological importance of work, and then the importance that psychology drew from work. And that's kind of ambivalent, because on the one hand, psychology and psychiatry, we like it, and we also think it's useless. So we have this ambivalence about it. So we'll talk about that, the macro view of work. We'll talk about the nature of stress. And here's my take-home message, which I shouldn't deliver at the beginning, but rather at the end. My work is extremely simple. When I deal with patients, it's almost childlessly simple in terms of the problems. And my solutions, even though I think I'm relatively well-educated and experienced, are sometimes equally trivial. So I'm going to give you a model about stress that is simple, but it's complex because people are embedded in it, and they're so embedded in it that they can't see it. And that's what I'd like to argue about stress. The third one is a pet peeve of mine, and I hope you will indulge me as I go through this pet peeve. which is I don't think we treat people well who are disabled in the workplace. 50% of my practice is with people that are off on psychological reasons, either burnout, whatever that is, or depression or stress, and they're at home vegetating. And I think everybody is the loser. So I've got some ideas about that and see what you think about that. And then I'm going to end with some common stressors and solutions. So let me talk about the nature of work, and we do a lot of it, and this is a graph so that women, these are number of people that are working more than 50 hours a week, which is a considerable number of hours, and you can see that mostly professionals. Can you see that? So up to 38% of men who are professionals are working more than 50 hours. So there's a lot of us are working a lot, and you would think that if we're working a lot, then we wouldn't have this Sunday night anxiety. But we do we not? I think I was traumatized early on, even in public school, because I had this great enmity towards Ed Sullivan, and I couldn't figure out why. And it was because he was on Sunday night, and that meant the end of the weekend and the beginning of work, Monday. And to this guy, he explains it quite nicely. He said that we can never be happy at work because we'll never be free. That to Aristotle, any kind of paid work is automatically degrading. And so this quote, all paid jobs absorb and degrade the mind. How is that? So there's a loss of freedom. To him, of course, there were only two worthwhile pursuits. Either you were in politics, you didn't know Quebec politics, I guess, at the time, or philosophy. Those are the only two things. And the rest, you let a slave do. So but we know that it's important, and it's important for a couple of reasons, because when we're with people, after we talk about the rain, what do we talk about? What we do, right? It's a second, probably most common topic of conversation. And we do it in a way, I hate to say, that's competitive. We sort of let it out a little bit, and when we hear what the other person is doing, we put that person on some kind of totem pole. That could be in terms of salary or power or prestige or influence or whatever. So that's why a job is important. We talk about it a lot. It allows us to compete. It's a way, when I'm a psychologist, I'm a particular type of psychologist, so I can express myself in a way. It allows me to be creative. Another reason why work is important. You can be an accountant or a lawyer in your particular way. So it allows this expression. I have a physician right now who is relatively lonely, and he loves Monday because he's got loads of patient contact, and he loves it, and he socializes in this role of physician. So it gives us a huge social network. It's really important. This is probably the best one. Can you see that one? It's your identity. I am a psychologist, and I take it on when I go golfing, and we're on the second hole, we introduce ourselves, and we say where we are, I'm still a psychologist, and I carry that around. So that's five psychological reasons why it's important. But, who are we kidding? It's the money, right? Would we be here if we didn't get a salary? So this is the amount I have a graph here, the amount of lifetime earnings. This is obviously not Quebec after taxes, but it's a lot of money. And it starts off nicely, because when you think about what kind of job you want to go to and what you want to be trained in and what you want to do in life, it sounds nice. You imagine a lifestyle, you select a work that would give you that lifestyle, pay the bills, you fulfill the choice, and it starts off nicely, but then it ends up like this. All of a sudden, that these choices become obligations, and you're working to pay the bills of the obligations, and you're caught up in a vicious circle that you can't escape. And again, the lack of freedom, another stressor connected with this lack of freedom and how we catch ourselves in this cycle. Great book, and I'm going to reference books. It's going to sound like a book club, but this one by the essayist and philosopher Alain de Botton, The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. And I love this quote. He said, the most important thing about work, it means, yeah, the end to freedom, but also the end to doubt, emptiness, and wayward desires. that he had a quote that we're only a few rogue cells away from palliative care. I'm sorry, we are. Thank God for our immune system, but it might. But we don't think about that. Why? Because we've got to write this memo. We've got to see a patient. We've got to get this report. So it distracts us from bigger things that maybe we don't have an answer to. You like any of these things? Why we work? When I'm with it, and it was mentioned in the introduction, I do right now a lot of executive coaching. I deal with managers and professionals and CEOs, and I ask them two questions. One, how important is work to you? And ask them a question about who's at work. And then the importance is, I can ask them various ways in terms of you as this role, as a lawyer or as a manager, how important is it compared to other roles? Being a husband, being a lover, being a father, whatever. How important is this role? Or how much time do you spend doing it? It's another way I ask about the importance of work. And these are huge figures that I get from people. 80% of their identity or 80% of their time, their non-sleeping time, is devoted to work. And then I ask them, who's there? Because we wear a mask when we come to work. And there are some people that wear only a partial mask, and there are some people that wear a complete mask. Some people go to work and they say, well, I have acquaintances at work, but no friends. I draw the line. So I have friends outside, but not inside. They know a certain part of me, but not the part that I keep for other people, my social network. That's all right to a certain extent, but that's another cause of stress if it gets to what this research talked about, a humiliation, that some people, either because of the nature of the job or the stress or the embarrassment of criticism, go to work with a huge mask, so they hide their identity almost completely and go through. They give the work hours, but not themselves at all. So they go with a very intense mask. And also, this is Belli's conceptualization. When we're at work, what is it? Because it's a job, which means that what's really important is the money. Right? It gives me something to do, and it's the money. A career is slightly different. There's formation, there's more identity in a career, right? You take the career with you when you leave at 5 o'clock. You don't with a job. A job ends at 5 o'clock when you leave. Or is it a calling? And a calling is something that involves meaning. So am I doing something that not only is my identity, but it reflects meaning? It doesn't have to be religious. It can be. You can be a nurse, and you can have the same job, and you can have three different nurses that view nursing as a job, as a career, and as a calling. And which one? And obviously, if you're viewing it just as a job, you're more likely to be stressed. The idea that I wanted to get across here is work has changed in a fundamental way. We were talking before about the role of technology and how technology has changed work, but even more fundamentally, work has changed. I shop at Costco, and I go on Saturday, and I can go, as you can go, in January and get fresh strawberries. I never think about where they come from. I remember growing up as a kid, I mean, all vegetables ceased when? In September. You could get anything. You get things that were canned or frozen or whatever else, but we never think about where things come from or the complexity of the supply chain. When I'm checking out at Costco and I'm registered that I bought this thing, probably in some factory in China or India, it's registered that I bought it. So a huge complexity of the supply chain that I'm completely unaware of, versus our fathers or our grandfathers that were intimately connected with work. They were close to production. They understood what work meant. Now work happens in technology parks or industrial parks that we don't see. I also have another, I don't know if it's because of some movies that are involving time travel lately, but I often say if I were to go back in time, like 300 years, like right now, zip, I'm back there, I mean, would I be valuable? I mean, I like to think of myself as, you know, semi-educated, but what could I tell them? I couldn't tell them about an iPhone. What could I? I'm a modern person. You think that I bring back? I can't make my clothes. I couldn't make my shoes. What could I do? I thought the only thing I'd tell them is wash your hands. Be sure to wash your head. That's really important, you know? So we're disconnected with work and the process. We're invisible consumers. And this is these are some jobs that I don't know what half these things are. MIS consultants. But you can just go down the list and see how the nature of work has changed. There's a psychologist that belongs to an organization of psychologists in management who tries to conceptualize this, and I like her conceptualization. Three steps. You can get a job if you take some mixture of quantitative or qualitative data. So you start there. And then you apply it to some product, program, or policy. And you measure at the end quality, value, or performance. And then you can make up a job with those permutations. And then you can call yourself anything. But all this is new, right? This never existed 100 years ago. So the nature of work has fundamentally changed. And also the nature of psychology and psychiatry's view of work. This is a, I don't know if you can see it, it's a photograph of the Douglas, and I worked there for after Vancouver I came here, and I was lucky to work with a psychologist from McGill, Ernest Poser, who hired me, and we eventually ran the behavior therapy unit here. But what do you notice? This is the Douglas. But striking impression from this is what? Somebody.
Large.
Large. Oh, you're genius. Thank you very much. Yes. And why? Why do we have a large? Well, two reasons. One, as a buffer, because this is an asylum and they're crazy people, so we want a buffer between them and the community. But that's not the most important reason. The most important reason relates to a revolution that occurred in psychiatric treatment in the 1800s, and which is the moral treatment, started by Quakers who said we can't keep mentally ill patients in chains, in semi-prisons, but they need a productive, work-filled life. Not only that, they need good food, maybe some spirituality, but they need work. And so all the asylums then were built with grounds around them, and they were farms. So the Douglas was a farm at the beginning, and patients worked. And there was a value in working as part of mental health to recover. The epitome was, if I don't know if you ski at Sunday River, but if you ski and you pass through Bethel, a small town, and 100 years ago, this was the Menningers of the time, and it was called the work cure. And there was at one time it was said that John Gehring had 30% of the male staff at Ivy League universities who came to his retreat to work in order to cope with stress. So, and work meant physical work, and that was the way to deal with stress. But I said that psychiatry and psychology were ambivalent. Here's a book. Well, let me just go on. There's another thing I wanted to talk about, which is still with the idea of the therapeutic value of work. I ask sometimes my students this question. What do you think the largest treatment center for mental health is in the world? And get very erudite answers. The Menningers or people from Toronto always say the Clark, or somebody says Betty Ford. But here's and that from another great book, The Power of Habit. It might be Starbucks. That's what I'm arguing. It might be Starbucks because they teach barista, average length of training is 30 hours. Half of that is devoted to actually making the coffee, but the other half is how to deal with angry, disgruntled clients. And they teach social skills. And there's this great book called The Power of the Habit that I would encourage you to buy. It's a bestseller right now. And in it, there's a story about a young man, Travis, from a ghetto environment. He saw his father die of an overdose of heroin on the floor and was hopelessly lost in addiction and crime. And then he was hired as a barista, and it changed his life in terms of the social skills and the sense of work that the organization gave. So that's the therapeutic power of work. But I said we're ambivalent, and this is what I wanted to say before. You get the opposite, and I'm sure this is not a book on, you know, at least on the top shelf of your bookshelf. It's called Fat and Blood. Fat and Blood. Not a very appealing title, but it reflects the idea that this chap, Dr. Weir, invented a cure just the opposite, the rest cure. So the patient was instructed to lie in bed for 24 hours a day for months, mostly women, by the way, were the patients. Special nurse would sleep on the cot in the room, feed her, keep her mind from morbid thoughts by reading poetry or whatever. and visits from family and friends were discouraged. So that was the total rest. And we have both right now, and we can't decide. We tell people to go and rest, and it's going to make them better, and we tell them to go and work. So we have these conflicting views.